Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Distraction Pieces Podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this is episode 116. There's loads of them, isn't there? Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm joined this week by another one of my favourite people to chat to, Edith Bowman. She's great. It's an awesome chat. You're going to absolutely adore it. We nerd out on film an awful lot at the start. So if you're not into film, then you're about to be educated and become into film. How dare you for not being into film? I should do the plugs at the beginning. We're brought to you today by speechofelementrecords.com. We are fully stocked up on vinyl at the moment and on Team 3W merch, which is the exclusive Distraction Pieces podcast team. So head to speechofelementrecords.com and check us out. But I also need to really give a good plug to the Distraction Pieces book. It's been mind-blowing, the reaction. I know I've mentioned it a lot, but the fact that we released this book, and it isn't just kind of, here's the top five episodes transcribed. I've written a load of new stuff in there. I've written a how to podcast guide telling you all the equipment I use and how you could set your own podcast up. But we divided it into chapters and then took any relevant pieces from podcasts on those subjects, if that makes sense. So there's a race chapter that has Akala and Killer Mike and Riz Ahmed, who is killing it in the night of at the moment and has just had a fucking action figure made of him because he's in the next Star Wars film. And he posted a picture the other day of his Star Wars action figure. There's a Star Wars action figure of someone who not only has been on the podcast, but is my mate. It's mental. And he's in the book. Thank you for all the support of the book. And if you haven't grabbed it already, it's available on Amazon and Waterstones and in all good bookshops and that kind of thing. So check that out. I don't need to bang on about that any further right now. Thank you for the reaction to last week's podcast. We had the Satin Lizard Lounge special because my spoken word stage, the Satin Lizard Lounge, was cut from Bestival this year. And there's been a lot of talk of Bestival going under or anything like that. Everything I've heard, that's not the case. And I need to express as well that despite us being cut this year, it's still my favourite festival. I love everyone involved in it. I love that festival. So nothing but love to Bestival, and it will continue to be the best festival of all. But yeah, we had a Saturday and Lizard Lounge special, and we had six of the artists who were going to be performing on my stage come on for a chat and do some spoken word. And again, it's crazy to me that I think in the first 48 hours, I think over 40 or 50,000 people had downloaded those two episodes. And that's awesome because that's 50,000 or so people all listening to poetry and to spoken word. And that's crazy, right? How lovely is that? So thank you for your support on that. If you missed that one, I recommend you go and check it out. But before you do, enjoy the one we got right here. I got to sit down with Edith Bowman last week. I went on to her breakfast show on Virgin, which was amazing fun, the most relaxed and enjoyable time I've had in a while. And then straight after that, we recorded a podcast. So it was kind of a beautiful double hitter. It also happened to be the hottest day of the month or the week or something. So I had a little stroll about town. I'll tell you what, actually, I wasn't going to mention this, but I was having a walk in the sun and I realised that it was time to head back to Essex because I realised I was unintentionally dressed as a wrestler. And Chris, I mean, I know that Chris and Stu won't listen to this. There is a drunk cast due soon, fear not, people. But my outfit, I had my training shorts on, so they're kind of like tap-out shorts, a bit Kevin Owens. They're Adidas ones, but that kind of loose short. And then on the top half of my body, bear in mind I chose to go out dressed like this. I had a kind of a denim top that was open, had nothing on underneath. And that denim shirt, I guess, had a hood, but had no sleeves. I had the audacity to have a hood, but the the audacity to equally have no sleeves. And I was walking around in public dressed like that, and I suddenly looked and thought, hang on, am I walking down the ramp to go and wrestle someone? Because if not, I need to get home and sort my life out. So I headed home. But yeah, it was a lovely day. I'm going off on a tangent. I hope you enjoy this chat with Edith Bowman. I think you will. We could have chatted for hours and hours, but she legit, as we discussed, had to go and pick her kids up. So we got in what we could, and then we got on our way. Oh, I should mention that next week's guest is Frankie Boyle. A lot of you have been asking for that for a while. I'll tell you more about that after this.
Want these headphones in, and I can try those ones. Then you can, yeah. One, two, yeah, they're all good for me actually.
Yeah,
I'm
that's perfect. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah? Ooh, so, oh,
pull it apart. As soon as I'm in.
Do you want? Should I put these under the desk? Let me put
yours. I'll pass these. Yeah. I'll pass yours under the desk.
There we go. Hi, you.
Well, that's a perfect start to a podcast. Podcasts always enjoy it when it's kind of a bit shambolic.
Oh, no.
And
oh, yeah,
here we've
quick.
Seen
oh,
behind the
yeah,
curtain.
Totally. That's like today with the show. We were supposed to play at this Kings of Leon interview, which I wanted to ask you about going to the strip club.
Yeah.
And but they forgot to send it to us.
Oh, really?
It's
I
like,
saw
guys,
a few people tweeting saying,
guys,
oh, I missed the Kings of Leon interview.
It's not come. They haven't sent it through. That's the way the world works.
Damn.
Yeah.
So I'm joined today by Edith Bowman. How are you?
I'm very well, mate.
And
really good.
I've just done your show.
Thank you.
And now you're doing my show. Woo-hoo! So thank you. And what you touched on there was I tweeted, I was once invited to a strip club with Kings of Leon.
Wow.
I'm not saying it was definitely them doing the inviting. We did a festival and part of their crew were really into our stuff. Like, oh, we're with Kings of Leon and we're all going to a strip club later, do you want to come? And I didn't go in the end.
What?
But I don't know, I just didn't. I've never been to a strip club still in all my life.
I have, but not when it's been a strip club.
Yeah.
I went to a party at a strip club, but they'd taken over the strip club just for the party. Mm. So they toned it down. There was no one naked.
Yeah.
There was a couple of girls and guys actually dancing around in, you know, skimpy clothes and stuff, but yeah, never been to a strip club.
It's intriguing. It's something I'm not against it. I've just never really seen the appeal.
Yeah.
Particularly since the dawn of the internet, when you can see
it.
Naked people if you want, men or women.
Yeah.
Just as much as
quite
you like.
I like walking around the house naked.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. But other than that, I don't really need
karaoke,
to go and sit in
the club. I am there in a second, but
I understand that. That makes perfect sense. The combination of the two is, of course, showering.
Yes.
She's a combination of a strip club and a karaoke club.
What's your shower song?
Well, recently I've been doing a wonderful a rendition of Kate Bush running up that hill for some reason. But it's because there's the placebo version is on some trailer at the moment. So it's this kind of slow, sultry showers I've been having. But yeah, it's an absolute tune. Oh, what's your shower song?
I've been Christine and the Queen song, Tilted. I just cannot get it out of my head. So,
and my dad loves it.
Dad.
It's really weird out of the blue. My dad every now and then will give me a tip on who's going to be big. And it'll be out of nowhere. And years ago, the last time he gave the tip, he went, just heard these girls, they're going to be big. All Saints. And he was right. He was dead right.
And they're back
dead,
as well.
He was dead right. So
they're back.
Yeah. I think it's been that long since he's given a tip, and this is his latest one. So yeah,
he likes the girls then as well.
He does. He appears
female
to.
Artist.
He's also a big. He gave me a lift somewhere. No, it was when we were going to Millwall, and all the way there and all the way back, which was we got stuck in traffic, so it was longer than the album. We listened to Ellie Goulding's album on loop.
Oh wow!
Just on loop and. I've not got a lot to say about the album. It's, I'm not against it, but I didn't need to listen to it three times in a day.
Yeah, I would have walked.
I'll see you later. So generally on the podcast, we'll talk about kind of your career or your upbringing or all these other things, but
I want to kind of start by just talking about films because we're both really into films and it's exciting
fans,
to talk about.
Aren't we?
So, yeah. So, what's your kind of favourites of the year so far or anything that's
weirdly
got you really hyped?
Yeah, there's been a couple this sort of quite recently, actually. Yeah.
We're past that summer blockbuster period, so now we're at the kind of the meaty.
It's award season starting, really. So, you start getting really interesting stuff. You've got the London Film Festival coming up as well at the end of the month. And, it's for me, there's been a couple the last couple of weeks that I've really, really loved. And both from kind of quite new directors. This guy called Matt Ross.
Yeah.
Do you watch Silicon Valley at all?
I don't. My brother watches
it
and says it's amazing.
It's brilliant. Yeah. There's a character in it called Gavin Belson who's played by this guy called Matt Ross.
Right.
And he's written and directed this new film called Captain Fantastic. And
I've seen the posters all over the tube.
It is, sorry to be completely cliched, it is fantastic. And it's weirdly, Matt grew up on a weird, not a commune, but kind of a loose kind of commune vibe.
Yeah.
So some of it is kind of based on his experiences in that environment. And it's about this family who completely self-sufficient, who live in a forest and have done for a decade. And through reasons that I won't reveal to spoil any, you know, storyline, they have to almost kind of reintegrate to society.
Yeah.
And what problems that poses up both for them and people around them. Viggo Mortensen plays a dad, six kids, and the kid actors are great and funny and adorable. And it's just a really lovely film.
It looks great.
And great soundtrack as well.
It's one of them as well. Whenever you get a film where there's kid actors in it and they're not having to do a Hollywood type kid actor thing, it makes it that bit more exciting and engaging. I always remember when I saw The Fall.
Yes.
For the first time. This is Spanish film, is it? Or Italian? I'm not sure. But
I can't remember. I just remember reading the subtitles.
I think it's Spanish. But the girl in that, I was instantly like, they can't have scripted her.
Yeah.
She's too good. They must have just not told her what was good. Like, her reactions. That like a child of that age can't act that good. And it's exciting when they're kind of children in more left-field films, which isn't that common. Like, you think A Little Miss Sunshine and a few things like that are the few to really cast, because in general you go left field and it's all older guys, unshaven, in dusty clothes, just not doing the Hollywood thing, just taking the time off from the Hollywood film.
Totally.
And when there's kids casting, they tend to, I don't know if it's because they'll have that extra freedom or not have that pressure of being.
I think the environment and the storyline for this particularly has, you know, these kids living in this environment, it's like they're going to camp.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing, and there's a lot asked of them in terms of the subject matter and their reactions and what they physically have to do to survive in this environment that they grew up in. But it's seamless, it really is. And then the other one is David McKenzie, who he's done some great stuff. He did Young Adam years ago with Ewan McGregor.
Yeah,
and most recently did Starred Up with Jack O'Connor.
Starred Up, yeah,
isn't it great? Ben Mendelsohn, I love it.
The first 10 minutes of it, I was thinking, are they taking the piss here? But because it felt like he was doing such a Bronson, almost a Bronson impression.
Yeah.
And when they had the scene where he oils himself up as well, I was like, this is literally they're doing Bronson, but not playing Bronson. And then half an hour in, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. It was like I said, I had that start of, nah, it's overhyped, I'm not impressed. And by the end, I was like, no, it deserves everything.
New one's called Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
And it's you know, it's crazy to think that Starred Up was a really little British independent film written by this guy, Jonathan, who was an actual prison psychologist.
Wow.
So it's based on his real experiences of working with offenders inside. And then he's gone from that to this kind of almost cowboys and robbers story, which stars Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and it's really great, and it touches on so much of kind of the state of the world and poverty, you know, within middle America and what people are doing to survive.
It has me hugely intrigued because I saw the trailer and I thought, this looks like my kind of film. Yeah. I liked Out of the Furnace a few years back, and a few of these films that are just kind of quite low key, kind of some kind of heist or conflict within crime. But they aren't films that generally get that much hype and excitement.
Yeah.
So I watched it and thought, oh, this will be my kind of thing. And then everyone started to say, this is amazing. And it's like,
Oh, right. It feels like there's a lot more to it than I maybe initially saw or expected. So,
and he's got there's a really nice story because he when he was editing it, him and his editor used, because Nick Cave and Warren Ellis have done a lot of film scores over the years, and they used some of their previous film score as test score when they were editing it, and then they were like, well, there's no one else that's going to be as good, so we have to go and ask. So they went to them and kind of said, kind of cheekily, we've been using, would you mind? And so they've written score for it.
Oh, wow.
So a nice little touch there as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. That sounds amazing. So what are your kind of, you're a fan of, or it seems that you're a fan of every genre of cinema and film, really. Have you got favourites? Have you got a specific area? Is it?
I try with film. It's like, you know, someone say, are you a film critic? I'm not at all, and I'd hate to be.
Yeah.
I'm a film fan in the same way that I'm a music fan. And I think with film and music, you almost have to kind of, you know, I don't read reviews of albums and stuff, and I tend to not read reviews of films because I want to give it a go myself.
Completely. I've started to, I mean, I watch every superhero film because I just think they're great. So I've started to not watch any superhero film trailers.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to watch the film anyway.
Yeah, like, totally.
I'll try and only watch a trailer if it's a film that I don't know if I'm going to watch or not. But in general, as exciting as it is, and it's tough when a Star Wars trailer comes out or any of these, but it's like, well, the fact is there's so much pressure on or trailers are kind of more of a key to the film being successful than the film itself, as we've seen with the critical reaction to
Suicide Squad
versus the commercial success of Suicide Squad. They had an amazing trailer. They had one of the best trailers of the year.
Yeah.
And despite everyone saying it's not very good, they've had one of the best turnouts in the cinema.
I didn't find it as offensive if everybody else did.
No, I didn't especially think it was awful. The
female,
it just didn't...
Especially the female character, Harley Quinn. Do you know what I mean? It's like she's a cartoon character. She's a comic character. That's how she was... That's how she's written. That's how she's illustrated.
Completely.
And I kind of like, what were you expecting her to be, head to toe in tweed? It's kind of like...
And I felt there was some conflict in that argument anyway, because I felt the main villain woman, that role would traditionally be potentially a male role. If it's the evil, powerful, and she was amazing.
She was terrifying.
I thought Carla Delevingne's character had some good variation. It wasn't just a typical female role, but equally you did have a Will Smith working out topless in his cell, which was amazing, and things like that. So I felt there was the balance of it. People talked a lot about Harley Quinn it being this overly sexualized thing, and it felt like you get a lot with complaints of people complaining who haven't actually seen the thing that they're complaining about.
It's almost like
you've seen an outfit and gone, there you go, that's not acceptable. It's like, have you seen the whole thing?
Yeah,
it's in the nature of it, and they play up on it a bit. But
totally. I totally get that, and I really defended it, actually, because I did. I think I was on Kermode and Mail the week that it was released, and Robbie, who was doing the kind of critic review and stuff, and I was kind of like, you know, standing up for the film sort of thing, because I do think that it got almost like there's so much expectation of it to be bad. People almost wanted it to be bad, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it's about kind of just going, having a blank sheet and not trying to go in without expectations and stuff. And, you know, I've got two kids. I've got a 3-year-old and an 8-year-old. So the diversity of films that I kind of have to watch are vast. I mean, I spent the entire summer watching everything from, what's it called, 9 Lives, where Kevin Spacey turns into a cat.
Amazing.
Which my 8-year-old, it was his favourite film of the summer because he loves slapstick. So seeing a cat trying to do human things was hilarious for him. And then it's infectious because he's sat next to you and he's almost wetting himself laughing. So you find yourself laughing. It's just,
you're drawn in.
It's really lovely. But then also I'm trying to, you know, show them films as well. So, I mean, Rudy's been watching Star Wars since he was 3.
Yeah.
And I remember being a kid and stuff, like Indiana Jones being one of the first films I remember having a big impact on me. But then I remember seeing The Deer Hunter.
Wow.
Probably younger than I should have been.
Yeah.
And it having two things about it having a big impact on me, and it's only now I've really started to think about it. And I remember that theme tune to it as well, which was dun dun da da dun da da dun da da da. And so obviously for me that's a big connection to film music, and it kind of staying with me. But just those performances, you know, Christopher, that Russian roulette scene in that film in particular, and kind of being, I don't know how old I was when I saw it, but kind of going, what's going on here? And I think it's because my dad had this kind of... My dad was really into, you know, the Vietnam War and all the kind of films around that kind of period and set in that time and stuff. And it wasn't that long after it, really. But then, you know, Meryl Streep as well in that film as well. Yeah. And just
it's weird how culture can inform a generation, because everyone knew what Russian roulette was. And that's weird, because it's not that it's not a very it's not an everyday thing.
No.
And weirdly, the other example is because it was in TV a lot of the time. So Russia roulette and quicksand were two things that, growing up, we all knew exactly what that was. Yeah. There's a lot of kids these days who probably don't, because it's not been referenced in any big, big cultural things.
Totally. It would be suicide bombers and something else, you know, the equivalent to quicksand sort of thing.
Completely. Would have that.
Yeah, definitely. That reference.
You touched on the theme of music there, and you do a podcast as well called Soundtracking, which I'm a massive fan of. I think it's absolutely amazing.
Oh, thank you.
It's talking to the directors so far, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were saying you might venture elsewhere.
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, the idea being that we, you know, the goalposts can widen as far as we want, really, because I think that, you know, I think there are certain people within the filmmaking process, and I'm fascinated by it, you know, and that's why I wanted to do the podcast, because I'm a fan and I want to know more and learn more, feed my brain. And so I think that people don't understand how much input, for example, the screenwriter might have in the music that's in the film. They might specifically write the music into the film. And that's the nice thing about this, is that Matt Ross, who we've done already, he wrote the film as well. So, you know, there's that where we're kind of getting into that world already, but also actors and producers as well, and the composers. There's so many great composers out there. Clint Mansell, I'd love to chat to. I think Clint's phenomenal. Alexander Desplat, who I think's great as well. I mean, Hans Zimmer would be great.
Definitely.
There's a huge, like you were saying earlier when you were on the show, about you've got a massive list on your phone
that you keep
adding to. It's exactly the same for me. I sat with a highlighter pen this morning and went through the BFI London Film Festival programme and highlighted everybody that I'm going to try and approach to. Yeah. I mean, there's not enough hours in the day to speak to everybody that I've highlighted.
I bet as soon as you come up with an idea like that and a show like that, IMDb becomes an addiction, because you can literally just start to scroll through and look at different films.
Signed up for the premium account already on the phone. Yeah,
just
totally.
Look at who did what.
I love the trivia section on IMDb.
It's wonderful.
And then you get that little thing where it's spoiler alert below.
I'm
addicted to it.
But so you've had a lot of great guests on already. And one of the things that I really enjoy about the podcast is the kind of nature of podcasts in general, I think, or their boom, was almost an anti-radio thing. Was that it's the voice of the people. It's not this polished thing, which means that often when a podcast is well produced, it sounds overproduced and it sounds shiny and unpleasant. But Soundtracking is amazingly well produced, but it works and just sounds it. I think it really makes it stand out, because you're doing something that, it's that perfect bit in between your experience in radio, where you're used to doing a well-polished and well-produced production, and the podcast world, where you can do niche subjects, nerd out on specific songs or topics or things like that. So how did that all come about, and what made you decide the format of it all?
Well, it kind of, the podcast grew out of a show I used to do on Six Music, which just didn't get the... It didn't get the love that it deserved, I think, on Six. You know, we were kind of, it was like, oh yeah, you can have two shows here. And then 4 months later, it's like, do you want three slots? And it's kind of like, it could be a more regular thing. So so we just decided, me and a couple of mates who I work on it, it's just the three of us. And we were like, why don't we try and do it on our own? So I started approaching the film companies and was like, look, any chance we could get time with. And weirdly, the first person that we got time with was Jon Favreau, which is a pretty big deal. But
it's
then to have that name. To have that name as the first one in the can and go, and we knew we were holding it back because we'd missed the slot for the theatrical release. So it's like, okay, we can hold it back for 3 months around the kind of when the DVD's out and stuff, which was great. So then we could go to other people and go, look, we've already done Jon Favreau. How's about, you know, you give us time with so-and-so. So then we did sort of think about how we were going to do it, because when it was the radio show, you could obviously play all the tracks in full. But with podcasts, there's obviously a problem with music clearance and stuff.
Of course.
And you can't, you know, you don't have the license to play the tracks in full. I think it's like 30 seconds maximum you can play. And so we talked about how we thought it could work. And so we did a bit of a test with John and just weaved in some of the music.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't do it. Ben does it, who produces it, who's phenomenal. I mean, he's David O'Russell was going to scoop him up as his music supervisor within the next 5 years, I guarantee.
Yeah.
And so we kind of did a test, and it sounded great not having the full track.
I was going to say,
it works really nicely with a little bit.
Particularly, again, the beauty of podcasts is you can cherry pick. So instantly, as I heard the guests who were coming, I was like, well, Jon Favreau, Ben Wheatley, can't resist these are people I adore. But then when because you're only playing sections of the songs, it's only going to be a 20-minute to half-hour show.
Yeah.
Which means you're willing to take that risk on someone you're not as familiar with.
Yeah.
And they can be the most intriguing. Again, if it was like, here's an hour and there's four songs, then you might go, I don't know who that person is. I'll wait for next week. Or, do you know what I mean? You'll skip on. But they're great ones to have that you can just go, I can listen to every episode of this and it's going to be engaging.
And the music is important. That's what we kind of realised was like, they're talking about stuff that's really important. We don't want it to feel frivolous.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got that snippet of the track within there. But then what we've done, because we really feel that the music's important, is we've created playlists on Spotify. So you can go to Spotify and for every show, there's a playlist of all the music that's played in there.
If you want to take it further.
Yeah. But I mean, if I did nothing else, I would quite happily do this for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And again,
I love it.
I think it must be exciting and fun for the guests as well, because in general, when they're on their press junkets, they're being asked the same questions, often people who don't know who they are. And particularly with Jon Favreau,
he loved his
excitement at when you'd reference specific things. He'd be like, oh, this isn't someone who's just been told, here's the Jungle Book, new film is.
Yeah.
Go and talk to him. It's like, you talked a lot about Swingers, which is, you know, iconic for me, it was
really fascinating when he was talking about, you know, he wrote that and he wrote in like Frank Sinatra tracks and it's like, there's no way we can afford any of those songs. So, and then even like with Chef, which I love that film that he's in, and you know, it was a real passion project for him as well. But you know, I do my own research, and I can't go in there sort of half-arsed and just have written a list of things that are in their films. I need to know the things.
Yeah, completely.
And so there were some little intricate things that he was really surprised that I'd noticed or referenced and stuff like that. But so far, touch wood, it seems to get a nice response. Could you do that thing where you expect the film company or the publicist to tell them, go, so your next interview, or you're doing an interview today, or that one's going to be about music, and the film, so they can at least think about it. Most of the time they don't.
Five interviews today.
So you go in and you go, hi. And if you've interviewed them before, they just assume that it's kind of what you've done before. And they go, so this is about music. And they go, oh.
Yeah.
And not all of them, because not all of them are as passionate about music.
I was going to say, have you had any yet that have been caught kind of off guard by it?
Not off guard, but Matt Ross was brilliant, because he was talking about... So what was great with Matt was that he's such a big fan of Sigur Rós, who he managed to get John C. and Alex Summers, who's a collaborator with the band, to do the soundtrack. And he'd been trying on his previous films as well. It was hilarious, but we were talking about him as an actor and whether he ever uses music to get into character as an actor. And he was talking about this play that he was in where he used this German experimentalism music. And because it was just it's a thought process, and it was something that came up in conversation. So he hadn't had a chance to plan and remember the names of the things and stuff. Yeah. And he was winding himself up so badly because he couldn't remember the specific name of this band sort of thing. But that's kind of really nice, because you know, I want them to feel, as much as they're produced, obviously, with the music and stuff, I do want them to feel like conversations and chats, because that's why it's a podcast.
And that's a situation is completely human as well.
Exactly.
Because what will have happened is he will have found a track and been so happy, but then who looks at the names of things anymore? Do you know what I mean? There's tons of albums and that because of iPhones, it's in my pocket or whatever else. There's tons of albums I adore. I couldn't tell you the name of half
I'm
the tracks.
I'm rubbish with stuff like that.
This one by this person.
Todd Phillips was really funny as well, who, you know, he's done all the Hangover films and Old School and Starsky and Hutch and all that kind of stuff.
And War Dogs he was on to talk about, wasn't he?
Which is his kind of step into awards, kind of more comedic drama. But he was talking about... I think it was Old School, and a scene in Old School where they wanted to use a Guns N' Roses track.
Yes.
And they were
like... He was gutted, wasn't he?
And he was like... So every time he kind of... hears Guns N' Roses, or for whatever reason that scene comes up, he's like, "Fuck you, Axl Rose."
No, in fact, it was in War Dogs. They're going into Vegas.
That's right.
And Las Vegas by Grand Parsons.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Well remembered. And he's like, "Fuck you."
See, I'm genuinely a fan. I'm doing the same as you now.
Axl Rose.
Yeah, but it's just like frustration. Yeah,
totally. And then I love the story he told about Snoop Dogg, about how he had. So in Old School, there was a scene where Snoop Dogg plays.
Yes,
comes to perform at this house party.
Yeah.
And when they were filming that, it was a nightmare because Snoop turned up with this huge entourage, had a massive rider. And Todd had said to him, if you do this, you know, I'd really be interested to talk to you about playing Huggy Bear and Starsky and Hutch remake I'm doing.
Yeah.
And he was having such a nightmare with him that he was like, listen, Snoop, I'm not sure it's going to work because if this is what it's going to be like on Starsky and Hutch, then I don't think we can do it. He went, hey, hold on. He went, for this movie, you hired Snoop. For Starsky and Hutch, you hired Calvin. And it was true enough. It's like, you know, he was the most professional person.
Amazing.
Every day on set for Starsky and Hutch.
I love that.
Nice little stories that come out of them.
Yeah, that's good. So, I mean, something you've done well in your career is going, right, I like music and I really like films.
Yeah.
Let's see how I can make this my job.
Yeah.
And chipping away. And premieres is one that I've only been to a few, but
I'm always there.
I was going to say, I think everyone I've been to, you've been hosting and interviewing beforehand and all that.
I do pick and choose, but I kind of like.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Like, what's the process of that? And have you got favourites you've done or ones that you've been particularly excited to do? Because
I've done.
The fact is, you can get to go. I'll do that, and then I'm going to get to meet this person and this person.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I'm such a kind of like, I wouldn't describe myself as a celebrity whore, but I kind of, it feeds into what I do.
Yeah.
Do you know, you build up those relationships, whether it be with the directors and the film companies, then you can go at them and go, listen, would you come and do the podcast?
Yeah.
And so I kind of see it as being, you know, it's kind of pimping yourself out, but I'm quite happy to do it. But I don't do them all, and I only do the ones that I want to do. There's been a few that have been a bit disappointing. Like the most recent one was Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling.
Gosling.
I had to think of my Ryan's name.
Yep.
Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe.
Which of the handsome Ryans was it?
Oh,
there's a lot now. There's so many.
And, just let's call our child Ryan. He'll be handsome. And it was, what was disappointing about it was like they had this access to these amazing people, Shane Black, the director as well. And they just didn't make much of the premiere. They spent all their money on making Leicester Square look great. And it wasn't streamed anywhere so people could see it and all that kind of thing. I was doing live Facebook and going, guys, check out the band. They had a band playing at Lent. It was great. And it was just a bit of a disappointment because no one could see it apart from if you'd spent the day hanging out in Leicester Square waiting to see them, which was a shame. So now I learned sort of through all that process. And if they come at me, that film companies come, can you do this premiere? I go, okay, well, what are you doing with it? What's the plan? Is it just for in the cinema? Is it getting streamed? Because, you know, it's like, it's kind of pointless otherwise.
Yeah, it is a weird one because, again, they do. A lot of people I won't know that they do sometimes do them, and it's purely for the people that are in the cinema. So it says the people who are there at
the premiere.
It's like
a TV show in the cinema.
For such a small room. And it's like that's a really odd thing to do, particularly as you'd imagine most of the people in there have been invited because they're some way involved.
Yeah.
So
you've probably seen the film before or you were on it. Yeah. Or in it. Yeah.
It's a really odd process. But as said, I've
all
what
ones
of them,
did you come to? Can you remember?
So... I'm trying to think. There was an Avengers one. Did you do one of the
Avengers ones? Maybe it was Iron Man.
Yeah. And then generally, other than that, the premieres I've been to have been the ones that have Simon Pegg or Nick Frost involved.
I do all them.
They're my mates, and you do
all
of them.
I do all them because they always ask, and I'm like, it's another chance to see these two. I love them. I love those two. We've got this
they're
little thing.
Best.
Nick, bless him, came on our first one of our first radio shows.
Yeah.
And we asked him to pick a couple pieces of music as we did you, and he picked Julio Iglesias, Begin the Big Rain. So whenever we feel a bit like, you know, we're in early every morning. If we feel about that, we kind of like, we've got this little clip, 20-second clip of Nick going, Begin the Big Rain, and it goes, and then he talks about dancing around at home in his pants, and it's like, I'm in a good mood now.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that.
It's like a tonic.
So let's kind of rewind all the way back, because I do want to talk about everything along radio and everything else. But when you were growing up, were music and film kind of key to your life and upbringing? Like, what were your big influences there?
I mean, my parents were the big influence in terms of feeding me stuff or just having stuff on, because I grew up in a little fishing village, you know. I'm 42, and so at that time there was, you know, you were disconnected from a lot of things, much more so obviously than we are now with the old internet and all that kind of stuff. But so, you know, I was kind of fed music through various things. I grew up, my parents, my mum's one of seven, and my granddad and some of my mum and her siblings ran a little hotel in Scotland. And so within the hotel, there was, you know, they'd have a Saturday night dinner dance. There was a band playing every Saturday night. They'd host road shows for the local radio station. At New Year, they'd always have like a jazz band on, and they'd have the local kind of folk club come and perform. So there was always kind of music around. And then my mum was into like local amateur dramatics, and one of my earliest memories is watching her play Nancy in Oliver and thinking that Bill Sykes had killed my mum. My dad went, "It's all right, just pretend." Like, I was three, like, "So, mum!" And then with film, my dad used to, we'd go to the cinema all the time. It was, the local cinema was up in St Andrews, which is like, you know, a good 10-15 minute drive.
Yeah.
And they, at the time, they had two cinemas. But I remember going up there at the cinema, watching like, I remember seeing the Fox and the Hound Disney film up there. And Indiana Jones. But my dad in the hotel set up a Saturday morning film club for the kids.
Oh, amazing.
So they used to have like a projector thing that they could, you could plug the telly into it or a VHS or a video player. And normally they'd use it to show the football at the at the weekends and stuff in the function room. They'd put it on a big screen. But on a Saturday morning, he set up a film club.
That's fantastic.
And so we had little cards, little membership cards, and every Saturday morning he'd put on a film. And I remember things like, you know, E.T. being up there, this film called Day of the Dolphins. Have you ever seen this?
I've never heard of it.
I always get the actors mixed up. It's not Chief Brody from Jaws. It's the other one who looks a bit like him.
Right.
And it was about these marine biologists who were training these dolphins to talk and to communicate. And then the dark side of this marine biologist, we were actually kind of being kind of infiltrated by the government, who wanted to use these dolphins to attach bombs to the bottom of boats, to all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I just remember this dolphin having a birthday and it being made a birthday cake, and
I love it.
The dolphin being called Far, and it, Far, love Pa.
Amazing.
I've got to find out what the name of the actor was, because it's going to wind me up, the old IMDb.
I love the weird, odd little films like that that just stick in your memory and stick with you. And generally, if you go back and watch any of them,
it's
now,
awful.
There's nothing of worth in there.
It's
but there will be
George
a small
C.
thing. George C. Scott.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
From 1973, Day of the Dolphin. There you go. Watch it.
I remember, I think it was a Disney one actually, but One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing was this just crazy. And it was about someone stealing the main dinosaur from the Natural History Museum.
Yeah.
And in my head, it was the best film ever. It's like, oh my God, it's this dinosaur thing and all this. I saw it on TV a little while ago. I was like, how did I even sit through this? Particularly as a child with the impatience.
Yeah.
And I was like, but yeah.
And then I had older cousins as well who started, you know, I would kind of try and, you know, they hated me because I was always hanging around. Do you know what I mean? It's like, please just let me listen to your U2 record.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I remember being kind of, they had to babysit me one night, and they were having a bit of a film night, and it being Breakdance 2, Electric
Brilliant.
Boogaloo.
Yes.
And I think it was Day of the Dead.
It's a good combination.
Yeah, which was kind of quite terrifying but fun in one night.
Weirdly, it's a weirdly logical combination of that time, because they're both genres of film that we wouldn't have had on general release over here. So you would have got on dodgy bootlegs or imports.
My dad's meat on the oil rig. Do you know what I mean?
So weirdly, the dark horrors and any black cinema, we didn't really because the UK didn't have much of a thriving black culture at that time. And I'd imagine the further up north as well, the even less. So it's strange that you think Electric Boogaloo and shouldn't be together at all, but they'd be on the same stool.
I remember one of the songs as well from that, There's No Stopping Us.
Yeah,
That was in the soundtrack for Breakdance 2, which then kind of led me into kind of discovering more of that kind of music.
Yeah.
And then a bit further down the line, we were talking about earlier, De La Soul, 3 Feet High and Rising, one of my favourite albums of all time. I mean, I went through three cassettes of that because I played it so much.
Amazing. And were there a lot of people in and your Strother. Small fishing village in this. No, listening to
my friend. So it's kind of weird. I had sort of a friend in a it wasn't a city, it was a bigger town called Dunfermline.
Yeah.
And she was going out with a guy who used to DJ when we were like 14, 15 at a club called The Cronk. And we used to sneak in with him because he was like, you know, one of his older boyfriends, cool older boyfriends that she had. And I just kind of looked on her from afar going, amazing. And we used to kind of go and do terrible dancing too. So he used to play just amazing. Loads of hip hop and lots of De La Soul and stuff.
Did that lead and inspire you to your TV debut at the age of 14 on The Big Break? The one bit of wiki research I did in general, I was like, we've got loads to talk about, but I like to do a bit of a look. But
it makes me feel
sick. TV debut on talent show The Big Break,
STV, hosted by George Duffus.
Amazing. So what did you do and how did that come about?
I sang Venus by Bananarama.
Brilliant tune.
And on the episode that I was on, which was, I was up against a girl who was a bit like a Victoria Wood, who played the piano and kind of sung kind of, you know, kind of joke songs.
Yeah.
A jazz trio. And there was one other, I came last.
Oh, wow.
And I followed my mum's footsteps, I guess, when I was younger into junior operatic. And we used to do things like, you know, Annie and all that kind of stuff. And I guess it was the connection. I was never comfortable performing. I was never a kind of obvious or, I guess, opportunist front person. I was in a band when I was a kid as well. You know, I was in my teens. And
what kind of band?
We used to do covers and play in pubs and stuff. Yeah. We were called, we had two names. We were called Warp Factor.
Yes.
And the best one, which was off the back of a Wonder Stuff tour called Groovers on Maneuvers.
Brilliant. That's good names.
We did the writing, like bubble writing.
Yeah, of course.
And we did covers like, I mean, everything from Queen to T'Pau.
Yeah.
Secret Garden by T'Pau was a big bit. Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love.
Fantastic.
We used to play like at New Year to like a dinner dance and stuff, a sort of younger people's dinner dance. It was great fun, but I was never sort of flamboyant and kind of out there. But the talent show thing, I don't know why I felt like it was the right thing to do, but I did. I looked older then than I do now, I think. I had a perm. I wore a puffball skirt.
Amazing.
And yeah, it will never go away.
It just comes back.
I thought I'd got rid of it a couple of years ago when Scott Mills was up at Edinburgh Festival when I was at Radio 1, and he was doing this late and live thing where he'd go up and do a late night version of his show, and he'd get people to come perform. He's like, Ede, would you come and do Venus? I was like, only if I can put it to bed. And I made them get a coffin on stage.
Brilliant.
And the idea in it for being me putting that to bed.
Amazing.
And that's still there.
Still comes back. Still rises from the dead. So what was your journey into radio? Because I first heard you on Radio 1, which is big. And that was kind of, what was your route there?
So I went to, when I was like leaving school, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, and it was,
which is worth highlighting, is completely normal.
Totally, I still don't know what I want to do. The actual knowing what you want to do is the unusual part.
The few that know what they want to do,
it's almost like eliminating things that you don't want to do is easier.
Yeah. So a friend of mine has recently, only at like 23 or 24, has just started a university course.
Great.
And she was like, oh, I feel weird. I've done it all around the wrong way. I left school really early and
now
I've been working.
Way.
I was like, That was exactly my point. It's like, you've lived in the real world until you know what you actually want to do, and now you're doing it. That's the way it should be, rather than at 14 or 15, they say, well, here's your options. Choose
what
the things you're going to do for the rest
now,
of your
decide.
Life. Okay, I'll start studying. It's crazy.
I went back to uni when I was, Rudy's 8. So I went back to uni like 9 years ago to do a night course in photography.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it so much more than I did when I was, you know,
it's the
properly
right
at school.
Because you've got the, you're there because you've chosen to be there and because you want to be there, rather than it's the next step in the journey that I'm meant to be going along.
Well, it was kind of like, for me, it was either going to be, I was going to get stuck in Anstruther working in the family business.
Yeah.
Or that I had to make a decision about what I wanted to do to get me out.
Yeah.
You know, and I've got loads of mates who are still there, and it's, you know, and they've got a great life and they're happy and they're, but for me, I knew that I had to get out. I remember like 17th birthday, the day of my birthday, I had a driving lesson booked for the driving instructor. He was waiting for me as soon as I came out of school to get me on my first lesson. It was like, you know, the first step out of Dodge type stuff. But so I went to, I thought at one point I wanted to be a PE teacher.
Right.
So I went to the it's not an interview, but it's like an induction thing at Morey House in Edinburgh. Got accepted to PE college, and that letter was like, I don't want to do it. That was the thing about it. Yeah. No, it's not for me. So turned that down. Went to my local college, did like a diploma in communication studies because it seemed to cover loads of things that I was into.
Yeah.
So photography.
It's good, it's broad, yeah, it's a wide.
Yeah, exactly. So it was photography, it was PR, it was journalism, there was radio production and video production in there, script writing. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I did that for 2 years. Then I got onto the second year of the degree in Edinburgh. And it was that gradual thing of moving away from the little village to the city.
Yeah, you just go in a step at a time.
Yeah, and then I approached the local radio station and asked them if I could get work experience. And at that time, there was no email and stuff. It was kind of like letters and phone calls. I probably would have been arrested for stalking if I was doing that much now. But I got in.
I love it though, because it's that much more effort. And now people, it's weird that we've built this internet thing that allows so much more access, but it's made people seem so much more clueless.
Like I've communicative.
I have a lot of people hit me up saying, I really want to do this. And the simple thing would be, well, have you contacted a local road? Like if it was presented, have you contacted your local? No, I haven't. It's like, well, just do that then. Like rather than ask someone who's doing it, just hit up those areas and figure it out.
And so I got work experience and I worked there kind of, I mean, my college, my degree definitely suffered because I spent every minute at the radio station just in the library listening to music or sitting in on shows or just making tea, all that kind of stuff. So they asked me to stay and do weekends and holidays and stuff. And then when I graduated, there wasn't any full-time work. So I was like, right, fuck it, I'm going to London. And I got on a graduate training scheme where I lied to get the job.
Brilliant.
Because it was between, and I'm sorry to the other person who didn't get the job, because they said to me, because it was in sponsorship and promotions.
Yeah.
And so by the time that I'd left the radio station, I had a show a week, but it was one night a week, late night. And they were like, look, we see that you've been on air. We're concerned that that's the route you want to take and that you wouldn't be happy with, you know, being in. Yeah. And I was oh, no, that was me trying it. I'm not, and I was like totally lying through my teeth. It was my ticket to London.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came down here, and got then applied for loads of stuff. Got into MTV when it was launched in the UK, thing because they wanted accents, and that was kind of it. And then Kat and I met at MTV, and we ended up doing a show together on Capital first.
Yeah,
and then my producer at Capital ended up going to Radio One, and he got me in to start doing the show with Colin.
It's great how kind of it can be quite a quick and or not quick, but that. A natural thing in that way, of them stepping stones. You'd think MTV is this unimaginable thing, particularly at that point, but there was a lot of people that just kind of, they just fit. They didn't, you didn't have to have years and years of experience or this or that. You go, right, well, like you, this works.
Yeah, or you're kind of glossy, you know, I wasn't sort of, and I'm a kind of, you know, glossy front cover girl sort of thing. And it was great that they wanted to kind of have a diverse range of people on that station as well.
So how was it when you got to Radio 1 and it was
it's mental.
You and Colin, and it was a huge show and it was huge audience, but the kind of beauty was as well that you had some control. It wasn't simply here's your playlist.
We really
at that point there was
stuff.
A bit more spot plays and or pushing stuff to be on the
much
playlist
more so,
and things like that.
Much more so than when I left Radio 1. The very much at that point there, and that's what I love about doing my show on Virgin is that Mick, my producer, and I, we kind of, you know, we're very much in charge of the music, be that what we play, but also who we get in to play.
That's great.
And it's so important. It's what it used to be like at Radio 1. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't have kind of carte blanche of what you could play, but if you believed in something, you could really fight for it.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a couple of things that we really fought for that when you kind of look back on and go, man, that's hilarious. You know, we were like, we got told that Snow Patrol's Run was not a daytime record.
Yeah.
That Amy Winehouse's Rehab was too retro. And Kings of Leon would never amount to anything. And
that's crazy,
like,
isn't it?
It's just, you know, it's like, but it's nice because you believe in something, you fight for it, and then it's great. You know, we weren't the only people, obviously, but when you see things kind of...
It's a great one because Kings of Leon are a weird one where loads of my American friends all thought Kings of Leon were English.
Yeah.
Because they were supported over here first, and it was Radio 1 and stuff like that that went, no, this is a big band.
Yeah.
Not that this is, as you said, they won't amount to anything. This is a big band. Let's treat them as such. And they got huge.
Massive. And then, they kind of, and then it snowballed for them where they kind of went. And similarly with the Killers, it was a similar thing.
Yeah.
Right over
completely.
Here, it was the same.
All started on this side and then blew up. So how was it kind of riding that wave at Radio 1, because it was also a wave that had a lot of pressure on it. And as you said, it was kind of a change in tides at the time as well, of going towards a less control and things like that. How was that? Was there any point where you kind of started to think, I'm not sure this is what I want this to be anymore?
It was gradual, and it was, you know, Colin kind of made the leap first because he just couldn't cope with it anymore. Do you know what I mean? And I get it, and I get, you know.
And he's he's incredibly principled. 110%
or not. Totally.
Yeah, exactly. And I think is amazing.
Totally. And I admired him. I totally admired him for that, you know. And recently when he left Talk Sport, you know, for something that, for the whole time that I've known him, is something he stood by for, and he won't sway on it at all.
It's bizarre. It's something that we discussed when he was on the podcast, and then that all happened like 2 weeks after.
Yeah,
and it was that kind of, well, there you go. He was literally just talking about it. And
totally.
He's put his money where his mouth is.
Totally. And he, you know, amazing. And I have utmost respect for him, and always have done for that as well. And he's brilliant to work for, and he's hard to work with as well. Do you know what I mean? Because he is so driven, and he's so, you know, it's 110% or nothing sort of thing. But so he kind of made the leap first. And I was, you know, I was like, I didn't think that they would give me the opportunity to do the show on my own after he left.
Yeah.
But they did. And so it was about kind of moulding the show to make it feel like that we had a bit more control. So that's when the film stuff came in, actually.
Yeah.
Where, you know, my boss was like, well, what do you want to have on the show that makes it USP for you? And I was like, I'd really like to start kind of making the film thing. And so that kind of almost made it easier playing shit music a lot of the time.
Yeah. And that was great, because you did suddenly have this avenue to promote films, and with film, because you're just talking about it rather than playing the film on the radio. Again, it's that more freedom. There doesn't have to be a playlist or something that fits Radio 1 as such. You can just go, look, here's a film.
Yeah.
I really like it. Totally. You know, and talk about it and get people in. It's not the same as going, here's a song that's going to be now played four times in the day and then so on and so forth.
Exactly.
Doesn't have to have that same commitment. You can have that control.
And getting behind stuff as well that you felt as passionate about as you did with, like, music tracks. Yeah. Like, I remember getting Shane Meadows in and Thomas Turgoo to talk about the first This Is England film.
Amazing.
And fighting to get to go, we this is an important film, we need to get them in, you know. And and it was brilliant. And I mean, Tom was so young at the time as well, and he'd not long lost his mum as well. And it was and they were brilliant. And
it's proper grown up in those films on camera. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I love all that lot. They're amazing.
Yeah.
So that was just that was lovely. And that kind of, and then from that kind of having kids then as well, and it's sort of, you know, and that kind of changes your priorities as well and what's important. And so I didn't want to be doing 5 days of radio anymore as well. So
yeah, that's fair.
I ended up doing on Radio 1 the review show, which for me was brilliant because it was being able to talk about stuff and music, and also being able to play a real diverse amount of things. And
the thing with a review show is that it is discussion.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to just be, here's this is great, I love this.
Totally.
It can be, all right, I like this about it, I don't like this about it. It can be more honest and open. And
because we were bringing in people from music blogs and stuff as well, and their, you know, their job as well as to review was to bring in something.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd have these kind of specialist guys coming in from like a metal blog, and so they'd bring in, and it was great, you know, to play that against like someone like Disclosure or something as well. And
I loved it.
It was good fun.
I did the review show when Nihal was doing it, and I was worried because I wasn't that into some of the songs. And one of the other guys, I can't even remember his name, but he was a journalist. And the highest score he gave, I think, was a 2 out of 10. He gave like 0.4, 0.3 and things like that.
Totally.
But it's that beautiful thing because the other guest on that week was Greg James. And one of the songs we were reviewing was that I'm in Miami Girl or whatever
song
is. And I gave it quite a low score. He gave it a 0.2. And it went to Greg and he's like, this is awkward because this is my single of the week and I love it. I've given it an 8 out of 10. But the beautiful part was he genuinely loved it.
Totally.
So there was no shame or anger in that. I watched, I was like, that's fair. You adore this. And that's why he was perfect for his show, because it's like, right, it's not someone who's playing it through gritted teeth.
Yeah.
It's doing it because it's what's right.
I think that you get to a point as well, or I definitely got to a point where it's like, do you know what? I don't want to be doing this anymore in terms of, I don't want to be playing, being told what to play, and I don't want to be... And so that was, it was great to go and spend some time at six as well, and that kind of started with doing the show with Adam.
Yeah,
which was
how was
terrifying.
That to kind of return into being a duo,
no
and
pressure.
To have the pressure of
bloody
being
hell.
A new person in a duo that was so loved and so.
It was like I don't know, putting on a kind of a Laurel outfit and a Laurel and Hardy yeah. sketch or something. Do you know what yeah. I mean? It was terrifying, but you know, we met up loads of times before, and Adam's so. He's so encouraging and he's so kind of given in terms of,
yeah.
I learned so much working with him over, yeah. I mean, it was only, I think we did, I don't know how long we did, 6 months or something, maybe not even that. But I learned so much from that, the short time that we did that show together. Yeah. And he was so, you know, he'd only signed up for a little stint because he had all the bug stuff going on.
Yeah.
And he kind of, you know, for him, the way that he does stuff is like, it's one thing at a time, you know, yeah. he has to kind of give it. And so, and then again, they were like, well, do you want to do it on your own? I was like, yeah, okay. So I kind of did it for a year, which was, it was a really
that's
good.
Amazing.
And then that's how Screen 6 came out of that. And then out of that came the podcast.
It's
so.
it's a curious one with Adam because he's got, as you said, you will have learned so much from him, so experienced. He will never realise that he's got loads to teach people and
no.
so experienced. I remember him hitting me up at one point and asking me some advice on podcasts. And
yeah.
I was like, you were one of the first podcasts that, like, you are podcast, the Adam and Joe
yeah.
podcast, and then yeah. the Adam and Eve, you did run all of them, were fantastic.
My biggest achievement with the whole time that Adam and I did the show together was the one and only time we did Song Wars.
Yeah.
And I won. And
oh,
he was gutted. And my song was about fish and chips. And he was gutted.
Of course
was
he was gutted. Because I'm
so good.
I remember him getting so bitter when the tide tended to go on.
When
it was Adam and Joe that
yeah.
he would start to lose all the time, so he would have been heartbroken.
We deliberately didn't go down, you know, redoing any of the Adam and Joe
yeah.
stuff, really.
No, it makes sense.
But then when he said, "Look, why don't we do a Song Wars?" I was like, "Yes!" Completely and utterly preparing to lose and stuff. I think there was a deliberate thing with the audience, kind of going, you know, they were having a bit of a laugh with him, sort of thing. But it was brilliant.
He hates it still.
Yeah,
he still
so
will have
much.
Taken it completely
so
personally.
Much.
Well,
he's brilliant.
I've stolen a load of your time, so we'll start to wrap things up. But what's the plans kind of going forward? Obviously, you're on Virgin now,
yeah.
and it seems to be great that, as you said, you've got that freedom to kind of
it's
create
exciting.
And do what you
Yeah, and we've
you
only
want
been on air 6 months. You know, we inherited the name, but we inherited no audience. So starting
right.
with nothing is kind of terrifying. But we've done all right with the first set of figures, and it's just a lovely little team. You know, my boss Liam's great, and Mick, who you met earlier,
yeah.
my producer, the two of us just kind of, you know, we work away at kind of trying to get people on that we really like and things that we really like. And I mean, yeah, I was off last week and I came back this week and, you know, played my first record. And I was like, oh, I love my job.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting up early, it's the first thing people ask you. It's like, oh, how are the early mornings? It's like, I've got two kids. It was a training. So I'm fine,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
I get to leave the house. Someone else has got to do the school run. It's
yeah.
fine. I'm laughing.
Yeah. The early mornings were already there.
Yeah, exactly.
They were
and, you know, I don't know how long it'll last. And I think being given the opportunity as a female at 42 to do a breakfast show on your own
yeah.
is brilliant because
yeah,
not enough women get the chance to do it on their own. It's all about being the weather girl or
yeah.
the, you know, the sidekick or doing the travel.
And the faith and trust as well that you, to not only have you, but to have you having control of it and having,
yeah.
you know, having your own input and your own
yeah.
choices
I feel
of
really,
what's going on.
Really honoured to be doing that. So
that's wicked.
I don't know how long that's going to last, but, you know, we're only 5-6 weeks into the podcast. So
yeah.
I really hope that it's something that I can be doing, you know, for the next, I don't know, 20 years.
Yeah, it feels like it's got endless potential.
I hope so.
As we were discussing earlier, the beauty of it being so specific and not topical, I guess, is you can stockpile and with...
Yeah.
The British Film Festival and all these other things.
Yeah,
is,
yeah, yeah.
Or,
I'm coming
or,
for you, by the way.
Again,
if your name's in that programme, beware.
Are you now looking at offers for premieres and thinking, well, I don't want to do that, but I do want to get in with that person
yeah.
to get them on the podcast? Because you said you kind of, you look at if they're broadcasting it and things like that. But
yeah.
are there any where you're like, they're not, it looks like it'll be average evening, but it's a good contact to get.
I am really bad at saying no to stuff, and I have to get better at it, just purely because there's not enough time in the day, and also just some. I need to make sure, you know, I'm spending enough time with the kids, and that's what's great about doing the breakfast show, is that, you know, I'll go and do the pickup at 1 o'clock for nursery, and then I'll do the pickup at 4 for Rudy finishing, and that's really important because I'm not there in the daytime, and it's, you know, you have that tendency to beat yourself up and make yourself feel guilty, but I know that I'm a better mum for working. Because if I wasn't working, I'd be going mad if I was a full-time mum. That's a choice for me. Yeah. It's not right for everybody else, but that's, for me, the right situation for me.
100%.
So, yeah, I have to learn to say no to things. But, I mean, this week's mental. Tomorrow I've got to go and do this live Facebook thing. Ron Howard's made this brilliant Beatles documentary. You think everything's been said about the Beatles. What can you tell me? He's done a great job. And again, similarly with what's happening with this Oasis doc, that Matt Whitecross has done, is that he's focused on a time period. Mm-hmm. So it's the touring years. So it's kind of literally when they went from, you know, playing the Cavern to playing Shea Stadium in New York. And it's great. It's really good. And
it looks amazing. The trailer looks great because it seems to have that really important, as you said, part of the journey from suddenly we're the biggest thing in the world to then not getting disgruntled by it, but then going, oh, hang on, no one's paying attention anymore.
Yeah,
like we're literally like we could just go and stand there and they'd cheer, and then we can leave, and everyone's happy. It's like we're musicians,
and technology, and you know, the equipment wasn't as advanced enough for what they needed to be able to do. Like when they played at Shea Stadium, they were playing out the stage sound through the tannoy system. Which, if you can imagine how crap that's going to sound, it's so bad.
Sound awful.
But I'm doing this Facebook Live thing tomorrow. They got in touch and said, oh, would you be around to do a Facebook Live with Paul McCartney, Ringo and Ron Howard? I'm like,
yeah, probably.
Wait 3 seconds. Yes. It's like, I'm a fan. It's like, to get these chances to meet these people is kind of like, yeah, I'm terrible at saying no.
That's amazing. Well, thank you very much. I'll let you get
and go and
do the 1 o'clock pickup.
Spike, mom, where are you? Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. And as said, soundtracking is out. Is it every Friday? I recommend that highly. And
keep doing what you're doing as well.
Thank you very much, and thanks for chatting.
Cheers, thanks, mate.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Pits Discretion Pieces.
There you go. That was Edith Bowman. How lovely is Edith? I mean, I'm sure you all already knew how lovely Edith was. I really want Edith to become the host of Film. And it hasn't got a name because it's a Film 2016 or Film 2017. Because that show's awesome. And Edith would be perfect for it because she just knows her films and adores them and can talk intelligently and articulately on them constantly. So yeah, I want her to be the host of that. So if the BBC are tuned in and you're at any point deciding on a new host, I put forth Edith Bowman, and you know, I'll come on as a regular if you want. I ain't mad at that. Thank you for tuning in. As I said, next week's guest is Frankie Boyle, and we had an absolutely lovely chat. He was staying in London, and he said, look, pop to my hotel and I'll spare you some time. And it's the first time we'd met, and he was just lovely. You don't know how Frankie Boyle will be, because he's Frankie Boyle, right? On TV, he's quite bristly and offensive. But he was a lovely dude, and we had a really nice chat. So tune into that next week. Who else have I got coming up? I've got John Bradley coming up, who is Sam from Game of Thrones. Oh, only the biggest TV show in the history of the world ever. Only that show. So I've got that coming up. I've got a whole load of good guests coming up. So check that out. If you could subscribe, that'd be awesome. In fact, I don't think I ask you to rate much anymore, and we probably don't get that many ratings anymore because we've been around a while. But if you're on iTunes, then just go and give us like a 5-star rating and help us jump up in people's estimation. It all helps. It all adds up. Anyway, I'm going to go. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I miss you and I love you. Ta-ta.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.